I heard the other day that there are only two kinds of prayers. One is help, 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 and the other is thank you, thank you, thank you. And that's the prayer that's so full and deep in me right now, for those words, to be sitting at table with Mary and Gordon, to be remembering Elizabeth, to be in this place that has been such a city set upon a hill for me. And may I also say, to hear this music. Thank you so much for that. That is real church for me. But I must tell you, as a Quaker, that if you do that with many Quakers in the room, you'll need an expert in CPR. Or but they need that. They need that. So keep it up. This is an extraordinary moment for me, and I have... I need to say I was very persistent in trying to get here, and I want to tell you that story. I've promised a number of people that I would. I spent the last 3 days up at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst giving some talks and some workshops, which was a great joy to find the spirit moving on a state university campus. It's happening everywhere across this land. The church is everywhere. People of God are everywhere. And when the time came for me to take my plane yesterday here to Washington, that Floyd fellow was over the two cities and between the two cities, so there was no way that plane was going anywhere, and I set about laying alternative plans. I learned there was an Amtrak train this morning at 5:30, so I got up at 3, felt I ought to shave before I came to see you and shower and so forth, and made my way to the Amtrak station, only to find the trains weren't running between there and Washington. Tracks are washed out and wires are down. Well, I thought, all right then, I'll take a Greyhound bus. And I went over to the Greyhound bus station, and the one bus that would get me here had a mechanical breakdown and was not operating this morning. And so, forlorn and lost, I got into a taxi cab in the streets of Springfield, Massachusetts, at approximately 6:15 this morning. And I said to the taxi driver, I have this very important thing I need to do. It's very close to my heart. This is not just another job. This is my life. And he said, I'll take you there. And I said, to Washington, D.C.? And he said, yes. And then, of course, my rational self kicked in, and I really believe in God, but I know mammon is real as well. So I said, you've been thinking about visiting our nation's capital, have you? And he grinned at me and said, yes, with the meter running. So I said, well, let's talk. And we negotiated a little price, and he said, now, don't worry, the meter is going to run anyway because that's the law, but we agreed on this price that it would take. And for the next 6.5 hours, I was coming down the freeway through the New York City, down the New Jersey Turnpike with this wonderful man of Lebanese descent who has a great journey of his own that I learned all about on this trip. But let me tell you, that even though you've made an agreement and you've shaken hands on it, there's no document here, but you believe in this fellow and he believes in you, when you get around Jersey City, as I did, glance at the meter and the figure looks like the national debt with commas in it, you start to wonder if you've made a very good decision. But I made a good decision, and I got here, and I have another story to tell. That's it. And that's why we're here, to have stories and tell stories, and I suppose that's what I want to do tonight. I'm going to do the Trains, Planes, and Automobiles, Part 2, that movie, you know, but it's going to be called Trains, Planes, Automobiles, Kayaks, Hang Gliders, and Bungee Jumping or something. I don't know, just many, many ways to get to this place I wanted to be. I think it's awfully hard to hear... clearly, when you've been so immersed in this ministry as all of you have, the genuine kind of significance it has for people like me around the country. I deserve no credit for anything that has happened here, and I am not a falsely modest person or even a genuinely modest person. But I really don't. The credit goes in the other direction. The credit goes to those who, from Mary and Gordon onward, and Elizabeth, have so faithfully cultivated this, what for many of us has been a city set up on a hill, a light in the darkness, calling us to something new, reminding us when we fall short of the vision, and encouraging us in hope. Maybe a parallel would help you understand that better. When I was a young man, I set out in search of community. I knew that something was wrong with the radically individual and competitive lifestyle I had been raised up in. And one spring with my family, I visited Koinonia Partners in Americus, Georgia. And many of you will, of course, know that great community and movement where Habitat for Humanity started. And there I saw people of different races living together in a common effort to meet the needs of the poor in a way that engaged those who had no money and dignified their lives and gave them what every human being deserves and encouraged their spirits and gave so much to the givers as well. I was there only 1 week, but the impact of that week changed my life because I had seen real people in the real world doing real things and could no longer deny to myself that that was possible. You know how it is when you hold a vision and you're surrounded, and inside of you as well is a denial that it's a nice idea, but it couldn't really happen. And once you've seen it happen, you can never deny it again. You always have a burr under your saddle, and you are goaded forward to new possibilities. Well, that's what the Church of the Savior, the Jubilee Ministries, the Festival Center, and the Servant Leadership School has been to me as I have worked around the country and cared about education and wondered how education could be transformed into something that reaches deep inside of people, that does not simply fit them for the slots that this society needs filled, but brings them into a wholeness where they can bust those slots wide open and invite the world into the kind of birthing that God intends every moment of every day of eternity. That's the witness that this school and this ministry has been to me, and I need to return the thanks 1,000-fold, because without that witness and without that ministry, my work in education would have been much the poorer. I would not have seen that something by real people in real time with real issues and real problems was possible, and I would have probably given up. But once you've seen it, you can't forget it, and you are forever changed. Now, what I'd like to do tonight in honor of that, the impact that your work has had on my life, is to talk in a little more substantive detail about what that process of transformation looks like, that process of inward transformation that then moves towards the transformation of the world. Because I think that the spiritual traditions, all of them, and certainly the Christian tradition in which I stand, holds a great secret that the world has yet to understand and probably never will. And it's the secret of the power of the human heart, the heart that is broken and broken open to God's working in it. We think about power in so many other ways. We think about the power of money. We think about the power of structures and processes. We think about the power of image and influence. But we do not teach and learn in many places, except places like this, about the power of the human heart, which is ultimately the only power, I think, that has transformed the world for better and for worse. It's the root of our power, and to work on that transformation for better is what you are all about. And so, as was suggested earlier by Sandy, I have been thinking, and she gave a wonderful version of my talk, and I want to dance with it because it was so beautiful to hear it come through your experience and your eyes, and I learned so much from listening to you. I want to dance with that, but But to say that I have studied and in some sense tried to engage for many years the question of how is it that human beings have come up against the principalities and the powers and have not yielded, have not given up, have not collapsed or gone empty or fallen into bitterness and cynicism, but have continued to engage with hope. We know that's possible because things like this happen. Because people gather all over the world to celebrate victories large and small of God's spirit and of the human spirit. And I have, in fact, studied movements in that regard, movements that I admire and honor, movements like the Black Liberation Movement in this country, and long before this country was ever established, that movement began. The women's movement, the movements for liberation in Eastern Europe and Latin America and in South Africa, the gay and lesbian identity movement, many, many movements which are attempting to assert in simple and compelling ways the dignity of the human self and the importance of human community. And I have written about this. I won't labor the details. There are just a couple of things that I'd like to dwell on for a few moments. Written about the fact that I think one can see in those movements four stages that a movement goes through in this work of transformation, a transformation that begins on the inside of human beings and moves to the outside of the world. I'm fascinated with this form that the mathematicians call the Möbius strip. You know this interesting form where you, I think I can do it right here. I'm a Quaker, and this is as close as we get to a PowerPoint presentation. It's this wonderful form where you take a strip of paper, and instead of just making a simple loop with it, you twist the end, join it together that way, and suddenly find that you have created a form named after Möbius, the mathematician, the German mathematician who cranked the numbers that makes this shape, in which if you put your finger on the what looks to be the inside of the paper and keep tracing it around, moving it around, you suddenly and seamlessly find yourself on the outside surface of that paper. And if you keep tracing it around, you suddenly and seamlessly find yourself on the inside. That's the shape of reality. There ain't no difference between the inside and the outside. We can kid ourselves into thinking there is. But whatever is within us is constantly flowing out to shape the external, the so-called external world. And whatever is out there is coming into us in ways that demand our attention and discernment so that we transform the wheat, we discern the wheat from the chaff and transform the evil into good. So in movements, I think what people are doing is finding their way onto the Möbius strip, always beginning in these four stages with this inner work that Sandy named as divided no more. The decision to live divided no more. That's stage one. I call it the Rosa Parks decision, as Sandy indicated, because she is so emblematic in our culture of the power of an ordinary human being to decide one day at a moment in her life, built, of course, on preparation. It's so interesting that Rosa Parks studied, as did Martin Luther King Jr., at the Highlander Folk School in Newmarket, Tennessee, under the tutelage of Miles Horton. Studied in a school like the Servant Leadership School, what it might mean to make this decision to live divided no more, to no longer separate one's deeply held internal convictions from one's outward actions, to instead let one's outward life reflect and manifest what the truths one holds most deeply on an inward level. That's the decision to live divided no more. There's a fascinating story, though, about Rosa Parks that I need to remember. Years after she became a culture hero, an icon, someone who unfortunately we've put in a glass case and we've forgotten her simple humanity, because we do that with our heroes, and thus we distance ourselves from them so we don't feel the challenge of their lives. She was 43 years old and a seamstress, not a culture icon at the time. But there's a fascinating story that Miles Horton, the director of the Highlander Folk Center, took Rosa Parks to meet Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, "Tell me, Mrs. Parks, when Mr. Horton was training you in nonviolent methods of social change, did he warn you that once you undertook these actions, you would be called a communist?" And Rosa Parks said, "Well, no, he didn't." And Eleanor Roosevelt turned to Miles Horton and said, "Mr. Horton, why did you not warn her?" And Miles Horton said, "Because the whole time she was at our school, she told us she couldn't possibly do these things. She would never be an actor in these situations." Now, we need to remember that story because we always think we can't do it. Even our heroes think they can't do it. But the moment comes when Rosa Parks and when people in this room, you and I, have that opportunity to sit down at the front of the bus, to say, "I will no longer conspire in the notion that I am less than the full human being that I know myself to be on the inside." And in the doing of that, something powerful and remarkable happens. It is a spark of power that starts to jump from one person to the next. It triggered the bus boycott in Montgomery, which gave rise to the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr. It was, of course, connected with decisions and aspirations that many other people held at the time. Rosa Parks arose as the emblem of all that. But in taking that act, she said, I think, a very important thing and a very challenging thing, if one is to say it. She said, "The problem hasn't just been out there somewhere. It's also been in here, in my conspiring with this system, conspiring through my silence, conspiring through my passivity, conspiring through my unwillingness to speak." And when you make that decision, when you make that claim about your life, your vision of the other is transformed. The other is no longer the enemy in the pure sense it is when you're still hunkered down, not willing to act, not willing to take your own responsibility in this. The other may still embody evil, the other may still be wrong, but you now understand something about the other because you yourself have been complicit in that evil for a while. And there is a bridge of some kind of understanding that leads away from murderousness towards the possibility of dialogue and reconciliation. I think it was that insight that led Martin Luther King Jr. to say, based, I think, on Rosa Parks' action, something that reached into the hearts of people who look like me very deeply, when he said, in any system of oppression, the oppressor ultimately suffers more than the oppressed. And as I started to understand that, I could no longer live the same way I had been living. I have often asked myself, as Sandy knows, the question, and I ask it today, every day, where do people who make the decision to live divided no more, the Rosa Parks, the Vaclav Havels, the Nelson Mandelas, the Dorothy Days, the Gordon and Mary Cosbys, the Elizabeth O'Connors, the many others in this room whose names we don't know, and out of the room as well. Where do these people get the courage to decide to live divided no more when they know that the full force of institutional punishment and sanction is going to come down on their heads? We know that because we know we live in a society that recommends the divided life. Everything in our society recommends the divided life. It's the thing I foremost learned in graduate school. Keep your subjective feelings under the rug. Leave your selfhood at home. We're not interested in that here. We want to look at your professional functioning, not the questions of your heart, right? I still, in the work I do with faculty, have faculty come up to me and say, it's not right to take my personal values into class. And the only thing I now know what to ask is, well, who are you going to send? If you're there, your values are there. I mean, but we believe in this society so deeply that we can separate these things, that we can hang our values or our selfhood or our integrity at the door and just go in and do a job. The society wants us to behave that way. Where do people find the courage to face up to the punishment and sanctioning that's going to come from institutions when they make the decision to live divided no more? And the answer I've come to is the one that Sandy's touched me very deeply by sharing the impact in her own life. I continue to work on it in my life. These are people who have suddenly understood that no punishment anyone could lay on them could possibly be greater than the punishment we lay on ourselves by conspiring in our own diminishment. That's the greatest punishment of all. I am quite confident that among the final questions I'm going to be asking as I draw my last breath, along with why couldn't the Cubs have won a World Series, or at least a pennant, for goodness sakes, hoping to have an answer to that in the hereafter. Among those questions, I'm not going to be asking, did I get promoted far enough? Did I get big enough raises? Did I gather enough honors? I'm going to be asking, did I live my life as close as I knew how to my own inner guidance, my own sense of what's real and true and good for me? That will be the question that I will be asking at some deep level. Rosa Parks' story gives us a powerful image of that. You know, that story is so full of marvelous metaphors. The police came on the bus after a while and said, you know, if you continue to sit there, we're going to throw you in jail. And her authentic response was to look up at them, smile sweetly, and say, you may do that. You may do that. I just love that answer, that response. Because it's a very polite way of saying, come on, what could your jail of stone and steel possibly mean to me who has just stepped out of the biggest jail of all, my own self-imprisonment in my own diminishment? Your jail has no power over me. Your imprisonment has no meaning in my life. It's been relativized utterly by the fact that I have just stepped out of the prison of my own making. And that, to me, is one of the amazing insights of the great spiritual tradition. We all feel in prison at certain points in our lives, and all of the great spiritual teaching is, the door is open. All you have to do is push on it and walk out. The Rosa Parks story is a story not of a person who hated an institution so much that she wanted to throw rocks at it and tear it down and destroy it. I spent the 60s in Berkeley, and of course that will explain everything about me, right? I only say that among friends. I mean, my mother still denies that I was there. And at Berkeley in the 60s, we learned a concept or theory of movements, which I now believe to be profoundly false. A movement in those times was understood as a rock-throwing exercise against institutions you hated and wanted to bring down. Well, I now see in the lives of Rosa Parks and Václav Havel and these others I have named that that's not what a movement is, that's not what foments a movement at all. A movement is fomented by people who love an institution or its purposes, its real purposes and mission, so much that they refuse to allow it to sink to its most pathological form. They call it back to its fullness. The reformers I know in higher education, the movement I'm closest to, that's who they are. They don't hate the university. They love the university more than the university loves itself. And they want to call it back to its great purposes. And they're willing to suffer on behalf of that cause. Hate is not what changes society and culture. Love does. And the movement of love in the human heart that leads us to live divided no more, which is so challenging and threatening to those institutions of injustice and those cultures of cruelty, is in fact a movement that's calling those institutions and cultures to their highest form of being, to their fullest representation of their own truth. I have looked back in recent years on where perhaps this notion of divided no more came for me or to me most deeply in my own journey. And I think I have identified the source. It is a line that I heard as a young person in church, raised in the Methodist Church, a line from Galatians that whose full implications I did not understand at the time, thank you very much, but whose inner meaning I somehow intuited and held as precious. And that is the line that says, I have been crucified with Christ, but I live, yet not I live, but Christ lives in me. And I think how I understood that as a young person and how I understand it yet today is that ultimately this is not a question of living my life, which can so often be an ego-ridden, aggressive, driven mode of being in the world, a mode that in fact falls into the hands of institutions of injustice and cultures of cruelty. Because when I want to live my life according to my designs, I want their approval. But what this line is saying to me is there is a life within you that wants to be lived through you that is deeper and truer than the life you think you're living. Can you be in touch with that life within you that wants to be lived in you and through you? The Christ life that I believe Rosa Parks manifested in the moment she sat down at the front of the bus. It matters not to me how a person names that life. I think many people in many traditions have courageously manifested that life within without sharing my language or my concept of it. But to know that there is a life within every human being that wants to live in and through us, and to daily ask myself, am I living that life or some other, is to engage in inner work that ultimately transforms cultures and institutions. Well, there are other stages in this model of movement and change. I don't want to belabor them, but I'll say just a couple words about pieces of this that I think are relevant to the servant leadership school. Stage two, after people have made this decision to live divided no more, is for those people to come together in what I've called communities of congruence. Because you make the decision to live divided no more on Tuesday, and you go to bed feeling terrific about yourself. Wednesday morning, you wake up feeling crazy. And this is a culture that knows how to make us feel crazy a lot. When we color outside the lines, step outside the box. And so we need communities of congruence of people who are on the same journey of making this decision to live divided no more that we ourselves are. And so the second stage in a movement is where isolated individuals discover each other in groups that exist to support each other's sense that we're not the crazy ones, it's the rest of the stuff that's nuts. I'm very fascinated with what it is that goes on in those communities and want to say just a couple of words about that before I close, because I think that it's that kind of community that the Servant Leadership School and indeed all of the Church of the Savior ministries are all about. Communities that help people to sustain the decision to live divided no more and to keep remaking it under difficult circumstances. I think those communities have certain ground rules to them that are quite countercultural. I think, for example, that these communities of congruence are places where people do for each other what the theologian Nell Morton said is the great task of our time. They sit there and hear each other into speech. Hear each other into authentic speech. hear each other into the speech of the soul, the speech of the heart, the speech of personal truth. That's a very hard thing to do in this culture, even in the most well-intended groups. I know what happens in the most well-intended groups when I or you start telling my truth. Somebody tries to fix us. It's a very common pattern. The tendency is usually you say your truth, it's a painful truth, and somebody immediately tries to fix you. If they've been to a listening workshop within the last 3 months, they ask you two questions, then they try to fix you. Have you thought about seeing a therapist, or here's a book you ought to read, or I had an uncle who went through that, and here's what worked for him. We have a gazillion ways in our society of shutting each other's inner voice down, of making each other feel unheard, and therefore of pushing each other away at these very tender and vulnerable and difficult moments where the soul doesn't want to be fixed or saved, it just wants to be acknowledged and heard. I have written in my new book and elsewhere about my own journey with clinical depression in my 40s, and I write about it not only because there is a personal condition called clinical depression, I think there's a social condition called clinical depression as well. And one of the most painful things in that depression was to try in this very halting, very way, opaque way, like fighting my way through a fog or a viscous fluid, to say something of what was in there and to immediately be met with a piece of advice and the feeling that once again I had not been heard because, frankly, somebody didn't want to hear me. I've got this image of the human soul. I believe the soul is like a wild animal. It's tough. It's resilient. It's savvy. It's self-sufficient. It knows how to survive in difficult places. If that weren't true of the human soul, some of us wouldn't be in the room tonight. I certainly wouldn't be. But like a wild animal, the human soul is also very shy. And you know that if you want to see a wild animal, the last thing you should do is go crashing through the woods yelling for it to come out. Like these weekend retreats, which I call share or die. I should learn to get my feelings out someday, right? Just like your music should, right? And when we go crashing through the woods that way, share, now get, bear your soul, get it out here, tell us what it's about. We know what's going to happen in the literal situation. We're going to crash through the woods for a century and never see a wild animal. But if we're willing to walk into the woods quietly, sit for an hour or two at the base of a tree, breathe with the earth, after a while, the precious thing we seek is going to put in an appearance. And then our task is not to trap it or advise it, but to be with it, to observe it, to respect it, to hear it, to honor it. And I believe that every one of the words I just used, both on the negative and positive side, can be translated into pedagogy, into ways of teaching and learning. And I believe the greatest challenge we have in helping people form communities of congruence around this decision to live divided no more is to hear that soul into speech with processes that are profoundly respectful, that allow the soul to emerge at its own pace and at its own level, that sometimes will take months and years, but that's the way people grow. And when we're worrying about effectiveness, as our earlier speaker so eloquently cautioned us against, one of the most dangerous things in these communities of congruence where you really want to get the movement going is the leader wants to feel effective by getting all those wild animals into the room right now and get it on the table. And that's not the way we grow stuff. Well, goodness, I don't want to extend us too far past our agreed-upon closing time, so I want to bring these remarks to an end. A movement goes through a couple of other stages. It needs to go public, not only to deliver its message to those who haven't heard, but, and this is very important, a movement needs to go public in order to receive the critique of the larger world, which is a world that also has truth in it. Because God is in that world as well as in this world. There is no this and that world for God. God's on the Mobius Strip big time. And so if a movement doesn't go public, doesn't open itself to, what do you mean by that? Or, I find that offensive to my understanding of what's true and real and good. Or, you're creating artificial boundaries. Any of those things that a movement needs to hear, because a movement gets self-satisfied, a movement gets insular, a movement gets a bubble around it that ultimately defeats it, the most noble purposes. If a movement doesn't go public and open itself to that critique and correction, it becomes one more form of fascism, small f or large f, that we don't need any more of. We've done that. We need a way of being in the world that's vulnerable to otherness, that's vulnerable to criticism, that responds to criticism not with self-defensive anger, but with the question, what can I learn from this? And the willingness, again, to sit in silence and hear that deeper truth that the critic may well have revealed. And there's a fourth and final stage to a movement, which I mention only briefly, where a movement comes full circle through people who've made the decision to live divided no more, who've gathered in communities of congruence to strengthen their muscles and their conviction, who have gone public in a way that's open and vulnerable. Finally, a movement starts doing something that I call emerging alternative rewards. Now, we could talk about that sociologically. I want to talk about it spiritually. Ultimately, the reason our institutions and cultures of injustice and cruelty hold so much power over us is that they control the reward system. We let them control the reward system. Not just the financial reward system or the status reward system, but the reward system that determines whether you or I have meaning and worth. And that's the ultimate evil, because God has given us meaning and worth as birthright gift. And so a movement has the very important task of developing and emerging with alternative rewards. And here we come full circle. Just as people who make the decision to live divided no more realize at the beginning of the road that no punishment anyone could lay on you could possibly be greater than the punishment you lay on yourself, and I thank all of you for the city set upon a hill, the light in the darkness, that has meant so much to me for so many years. Thank you very much.